Hi, everyone. Welcome to this post-U.S. Open edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. Ryan Ballingy, and it's great to have you here with us. You can get a hold of me on Twitter, at Ryan Ballingy. You can find Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. All of our work is at golfnewsnet.com. You can download our apps for Amazon Fire TV and Roku TV. And we are presented by the Myrtle Beach World Amateur Handicap Championship, or the PlayMyrtleBeach.com World Am, which is what it is this year. There are more than 2,800 players who have signed up to compete in this year's World Am. We have two of them in our team, and that's Mitch Lawrence, who lives down that part of the world. He'll be doing some activities down there as well on the official side of things. And then I'll be down there playing my first World Am. I was down there just as a visitor, not as a competitor, a couple of years ago, as went through Myrtle Beach with my family before, you know, as part of a family vacation. I stopped by the world's largest 19th hole with my friends John McGinnis and Brian Katrick. I got to meet John Daly and hang out with him for a little while. Obviously spent some time with Mitch and his wife Ava Lawrence, who is one of the greatest pool players you'll ever see and an awesome person to boot. And so we decided to get together with the folks at Golf Marketing Solutions, better known as Myrtle Beach Golf Holiday, and another iteration of their name, to try to drive people to come learn more about this championship. So it's in August, tail end of August. You can learn more about it at thegolfnewsnet.com/worldam. We have a package put together where you can either stay at the Sheraton, which adjoins the world's largest 19th hole in the Myrtle Beach Convention Center, or you can stay wherever you choose, and you can get a discount on what it costs to play in the championship. You're going to get five rounds, maybe a sixth, if you're fortunate enough to play well in your handicap group, and that's divided by skill level as well as gender. And if you do win your group, or you get you place highly enough in your group, then you get into the final day shootout, the extra day shootout to determine the overall champion, which is pretty neat. You're going to get a great course, you're going to get a medium course, and you're going to get a couple high-end courses in there in your four official rounds, and then we're going to do a round together as a group with the folks who come with us through GNN. So head over to thegolfnewsnet.com/worldam to find out more. It's very affordable. I mean, the overall package with Sheraton and all the golf included, and the $300 gift bag, and the food and drink, and the all-you-can-drink at the 19th hole, you're going to save an incredible amount of money. It's $1,175 to do the package with us. It's obviously less money without the hotel. If you're just staying, you still save that $100. But either way, you're getting an incredible value for the money. So you should take us up on this offer and over to thegolfnewsnet.com/worldam to find out more and book your trip. So I wanted to talk about the U.S. Open. Obviously, Brooks Koepka won. And when I was going through my picks leading into the championship, all the fantasy stuff that we do, I mean, we do a lot of fantasy stuff every week, but obviously some special fantasy stuff heading into the major championships. I did our one-and-done picks, and I post them publicly every week so everyone can see how I do. And I kind of had it down to four guys. And I said this in all the radio interviews I did ahead of time, and obviously said it in the stuff that I've done and written for Golf News Net. And I had it down to four players: Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, Justin Rose, and Justin Thomas. Pretty much in that order. And I went with Dustin Johnson in one and done, thinking, in part, there's no way Brooks Koepka is going to win back-to-back. That hasn't happened in 29 years. And so I didn't pick him, even though I really wanted to pick him. And went with Dustin Johnson instead, who obviously finished third. But Brooks Koepka was amazing. I mean, he was just a stunning display of golf down the stretch. The way that he got up and down for par on 14 on Sunday was astounding. That basically locked up the tournament. The birdie on 16 with that wedge shot in to, what, about foot and a half. That was obviously the nail in the coffin. Played 17 just fine, and then 18... must have had a little nervous energy hitting the ball well left of the green, but frankly, luckily for him, hitting the grandstand, bouncing off, and being able just to chip on, and then two putt for the winning bogey to finish at 1 over 281, which is a 17-stroke difference against par compared to the 16-under score he shot last year. Now, that was on a par 72 course, so the par was 288. If you take that two strokes per round away, as we've talked about before, the winning score would have been minus 8. So consider it really a 9-shot difference in terms of how the golf course is played for the champion. year over year, going from Erin Hills to Shinnecock Hills. The big difference over the weekend between the two guys I most liked going into the tournament, Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka, was putting. And that kind of makes sense, right? I mean, they're both incredible drivers of the golf ball, very far. The fairways weren't an issue in terms of hitting them for these guys, for the most part. I mean, they missed some fairways, but for the most part, really wasn't an issue because they were pretty wide and generous. They bounced plenty, so it wasn't like you weren't getting rollout. So these guys had a more magnified advantage in some sense because of how far they hit the ball. And they're both pretty solid wedge players. Dustin, I would put better than Brooks, but I would say Brooks is pretty solid with the iron game, generally speaking, and probably close to the level of Dustin Johnson. They could compete in a four-round basis, if that makes sense. Long-term trend, you pick DJ, but in one tournament, could be about the same. And then it came down to putting. And over the final 36 holes, the strokes gained putting difference between Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka was about 10 strokes. There's your golf tournament. So from tee to green, Dustin Johnson was better than Brooks Koepka. But he wasn't better in terms of putting. And that was what carried Dustin Johnson for the first 36 holes. He played so well around the greens, and he had a real ingenuity about where to miss. And when he did miss, he managed to get up and down. He made those clutch putts, and that even being on the wrong side of the draw, having to go out late early on Thursday, Friday, he still managed to carry a four-shot lead into the weekend. But at some point early in the Saturday round, he just lost confidence with the putter. That started to lead to, I think you'd look at it number two, that started to lead the way toward losing confidence overall. And then it looked like he felt timid hitting putts for the remainder of the weekend. Certainly all of Saturday, most of Sunday, I think. And when you lose that confidence, it's really hard to get it back. It's especially tough to get it back under really trying conditions. The golf course was on the edge on Saturday. Even though everyone else is suffering around you, it still has to be a horrible feeling thinking, I'm going to shoot 77. I'm going to shoot 78, 81. Ricky Fowler shot 84. I mean, there are a lot of the average on the final 11 groups was about 5 shots more than the average for the first 11 groups. That's how we got a Daniel Berger, Tony Finau final pairing. But you're not thinking about that in the moment. You're thinking about, how am I letting this get away from me? Especially, and something we'll get to in a few minutes, comparing these guys, how they play week to week on the PGA Tour to how they play in a USGA Championship. Because on the PGA Tour, birdies are good. Pars are, you're probably losing something in the field. Birdies and eagles, good. You know that frame of reference. In this championship, you know pars are very good and birdies are fantastic. The field was, for the first 2 days, averaged 2 birdies per player per round. That's nuts compared to the PGA Tour. I had one birdie, and it felt like $1 million when I played Shinnecock. It was number 10, and that was by total accident, to be truthful. I wanted to play away from the pin that day, and I kind of fanned it over there, and it wound up 7 feet from the hole. That shouldn't have happened. But for these guys playing in much more difficult conditions, much more difficult ground conditions, certainly, I mean, the golf course was stressed out to the point that obviously bounced a lot more. And as you're watching this unfold, Dustin Johnson, personally watching through his own personal experience, has to be thinking, I'm letting this get away. But then you look at the leaderboard, and he's really not. I mean, he was in it. He was in it the final day. And he had to, in one sense, feel good about that, shooting 77 on Saturday, but another part feeling like he let it get away from him. So on Sunday, the putter just went dry again, timid, short, coming out of it really quickly. And I thought the best contrast between how Brooks Koepka and Dustin Johnson felt putting was on 14. Koepka had, a 7-8 footer to save par and really retain all the momentum he had built throughout the round. He makes a left edge putt. He's just standing over it. You know he feels like he's going to make it. He's aimed properly. He takes a very confident stroke and makes it. Huge uproar. That's basically the tournament. Dustin Johnson's a foot and a half closer. It's the same putt. Basically the same putt. Left edge, hit it firm, it'll go in. And Dustin Johnson didn't. He didn't hit it with the right pace, and he fanned it, came out of it very quickly. And in that moment, he knew he couldn't win the U.S. Open. That was it. And that's kind of weird that it comes down to a putting contest. That's not what the U.S. Open typically is. But in this case, with two world-class ball strikers, there's got to be one way or another to differentiate them. That was it. And ultimately, Brooks putted better, and he handled the stress better, and he seemed to take all the things that came at him or that he did to himself better. He never seemed to flinch. I mean, never really seemed to slump his shoulders. He had his chest out, confident, ready to go. And probably part of that came from doing it last year, and probably part of it just came from naturally being a confident player. I mean, when you hear Brooks Koepka speak, he sounds like a really confident guy. I mean, extremely confident. You have to be very sure of yourself to play at this level. Almost too sure of yourself. Delusionally sure of yourself to be a champion in golf. And when you lose that, then you're no longer, you don't have that edge. The edge is gone. You've lost it. And it's almost impossible to get it back. So right now, Koepka hasn't lost it. He's got it. And that may lead to an incredible career. If you look at his major results, he obviously has two U.S. Open titles. He has gotten better in the Masters every year he has played in it. He missed it this year with wrist tendon surgery. He's had a good finish in the Open Championship, I think two. He nearly won a PGA Championship in 2016, probably should have, instead of Jimmy Walker. So at this point, he's had a lot of close calls, and he's turned those into learning opportunities to get better. And yeah, he only has three PGA Tour wins at this point, but I think that speaks more to where his game can shine than what the PGA Tour offers. And that's a perfect segue into how I feel about how the USGA handled the setup of this championship compared to how the PGA Tour works week in and week out. I thought Andy Johnson did a fantastic job writing up this facet of the championship and the contrast to the PGA Tour on his website, The Fried Egg. And his contrast, I think, makes a ton of sense because, as I mentioned, week to week on the PGA Tour, the frame of reference for scoring is really easy. It's birdies and eagles. Birdies are good. Eagles are great. Pars, bogeys are worse. Double bogeys are frightening at most events. I mean, they're basically a tournament ender for most people on the PGA Tour. And at the U.S. Open, that's not the case. The frame of reference is, again, par is amazing. You've accomplished something. Birdie is fantastic. And an eagle's practically unheard of. I mean, there were some at the fifth throughout the week, but practically unheard of. And some players, I would argue most players, have difficulty adjusting to that because the stress changes. It changed this week. The PGA Tour doesn't really emphasize driving. This Open did. You just didn't realize it. This Open emphasized driving by finding the right portion of the fairway to give the appropriate angle to play into these pins. And if you didn't find the appropriate angle and you still went for the pin, you could find yourself penalized very quickly. And so the adjustment had to be made of knowing when you hit a good drive and when you had an opportunity to score versus not hitting a good drive, even if you found the fairway, and knowing when to throttle back. Koepka handled that very well. Dustin Johnson handled that very well. They had really good game plans over the course of the week. Henrik Stenson and Justin Rose handled it very well. Obviously, they did not finish as they would have wished given their position on Saturday afternoon. And Daniel Berger and Tony Finau, for them, just putts didn't fall more than anything else. I don't think there was anything impugning their strategy. It just didn't kind of work out for them. And part of that, I wonder, by the way, as an aside, is did they both realize in the back of their mind they shouldn't have been in the last group? Or maybe that, not that they shouldn't have been, but they thought they shouldn't have been in the last group because they came from 11 behind to start the day to somehow wind up in the last group on Sunday at the U.S. Open. Do you think part of that crept in their mind, like, this doesn't make sense. We shouldn't be here. And then that's why they didn't win? I'm curious about that. We'll see. Maybe they'll say something about it someday. But I think about that. Nonetheless, you know, the frame of reference changed, and Brooks Koepka handles it. All right, well, this is what you're throwing at me now. I'll deal with it. I will make the best of it. Versus other guys who just didn't. And part of that had to do with draw. The Thursday-Friday draw was important. If you went late early and you weren't Dustin Johnson and you were a star player, you really had a bad chance of making the cut. Look at the guys that got tagged. Rory McIlroy, John Rahm, Jordan Spieth, Tiger Woods. And those guys had slumped shoulders early in their round on Thursday. They were getting beaten down, and they didn't feel like they could rise above it. And that doesn't happen a lot on the PGA Tour. Like, if you have a bad round on the PGA Tour and you're a star player, it's not because the course is beating you. It's because you beat yourself. Like, you did something. Like, you are hungover, or you took 3 weeks away, or your mind's somewhere else. Something else is going on in your life that's consuming your mind. And some days you can just have an off day. But you can recover from that in a PGA Tour event. You can win from the cut line. Doesn't happen often, but you can win from the cut line. Almost happened at this Open. But winning from the cut line at a PGA Tour event seems almost impossible. Like, but you could still find your way with a good weekend to back into a top 10 or top 15 finish. Make good money, and okay, well, that one got away, but I've got another one. I've got 40 events. Actually, there are 47 official events on the PGA Tour. Take away the four majors, you got basically 45. 43 events. So if one gets away from you, there's always the next one. But that's not the case in the majors. The majors are, first of all, there are only four. Second, there's only one of each major each year. And a lot of the PGA Tour events, I mean, they're well-run, but they seem to run together. And they're kind of thematic. You know, all right, we're going to go play a Pete Dye course. Well, there are like five of those events on the PGA Tour. It just kind of feels that way. Yeah, there are four WGCs. All right, well, I didn't get this one, but I got another three coming. Oh, I didn't get the players. Well, there are also extremely good purses for these 10 tournaments, and they're all very important in terms of the season. It doesn't feel that way at the U.S. Open. Like, you let it get away from you in the first 10 holes, it's really hard to come back from that. That makes what Brooks Koepka did even more special, in my opinion. He was, what, 7 over through 25 holes, and he still finished the remainder of the championship, the final 47 holes, in 6 under par. That's amazing to me that he managed to save that. And it's because he didn't let it get him down. Probably in part because he had one. Probably in part because he knew he could do it. And there are a lot of, not mentally weak guys, but mentally fragile guys on the PGA Tour who carry themselves with a great talent, and they do well, and they talk a good game. But you get them frustrated, and they could weeble wobble. Rory is one of those guys. John Rahm's one of those guys. I really thought Spieth wasn't one of those guys, but I think he's turning into one of them. He seems to kind of have a sense of resignation when he's not playing his best. And I think that happened to him here. And then you kind of got guys like Justin Thomas and Ricky Fowler, who seem to actually kind of thrive when the conditions get tougher. That's just the statistical play out of that. But I'm curious if, as these guys age, they will get mentally stronger, or they'll just get set in their ways. And they'll be not happy, but this is how they will function. You know, they get a bad side of the draw. All right, well, I'm not going to make the best of it. I'm out. Bad luck. That's it. Move on to the next thing. Because that's how Rory McIlroy feels right now to me. He probably will not win at Carnoustie, so he's going to go to Belrive for the final August PGA Championship in a few months, and that's going to be his last chance to end a four-year skid. If not, he's going to go into year five of a skid that could end at the 2019 Masters. And his comments about feeling like he can only care about three major championships now, that he takes the U.S. Open out of the equation in terms of the majors he can win, is kind of stunning to me. I mean, for a guy of his caliber, for a guy of his talent and depth and ability, for him to say he doesn't think he can win that major, man, that's, I don't think I would have ever heard that if we were in a different generation. We certainly would have heard it from Tiger. I don't think we would have heard it. I mean, we still didn't hear it from Phil, who was second place at this event 6 times. We'll get to Phil in a minute. He never said that. Never said, "Oh, I can't win this. I can only care about three majors." And then he said, "Well, Rory said earlier in the year, well, I only really care about the Masters because that's what he needs to complete the career Grand Slam." So if that's the one he cares about, but he worries that he can't win, he doesn't care about the U.S. Open. He's obviously not as interested in the British Open because that's not the brand of golf he prefers. There's really only one major he can come into feeling kind of free and clear, and that's the PGA Championship. So, I mean, he's basically mentally blocked off three majors every year for one reason or another. That's a remarkable thing for a guy of his talent. Spieth has me very concerned. He's in deep trouble. His long game has left him, and that's really been the strong suit of his game for the last 2 years. His long-term strokes game putting trend is negative. I mean, he's the rolling average over 2 years is negative. So the thing that kind of got him known in the first place is now a detriment to his game, which I think is frightening. And I think it's also what I kind of talked about in the Ryder Cup in 2016. So I'm going to reveal something. It's going to sound foolish, and part of it was alcohol-fueled, but there was a rationale behind it. So, at the 2016 Ryder Cup, stayed in the house with a bunch of different folks, including Stephanie Way, who organized it, Teddy Greenstein, Shane Ryan, John McCarthy from Canada, Kevin Van Valkenburg, and I'm trying to remember if there's someone else I missed there, but we had a really good house, and we had a hot tub, and beer, and liquor. And one night we all kind of hung around the hot tub and started talking about things. And I was adamant that Jordan Spieth, and this is the flippant part, would be out of the world top 50 by the next time we had a Ryder Cup. And everyone was like, "You're an idiot." And I was like, "Yeah, this is kind of, I mean, that point's kind of flippant, but I believe he will falter. I believe he will have a career somewhat like Tom Watson's, where Watson, at the beginning, struggled way more than Spieth ever did. Took him, I believe, 99 starts to rack up his first PGA Tour win. But after he won for the first time, he went on this enormous tear. And then all of a sudden, by age 32, he was done. I mean, he was seriously done. I mean, won here and there, but he was basically done. So he had about a 7-year, 8-year run. Spieth right now is in year 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. So really in the fifth year of a run. He's won three major championships, which is incredible. And he's obviously posted a dozen wins on the PGA Tour. Very remarkable. But something has changed in his game. His putting has not been reliable over the last couple of years. His short putting is particularly a problem. His long game has left him. He's obviously not the longest hitter on the PGA Tour, so that puts him behind the eight ball a little bit. But his iron play is not saving him. And when nothing's going right, I feel like he's lost some of that grinder mentality that he once had, that maybe he had when he felt disrespected, but now he's Jordan Spieth, man. He won three majors. So he almost kind of feels like maybe it's got to come to him. And when it's not, the result is what happened to the U.S. Open. And I wonder if he feels as close to winning as he did maybe a few months ago. And if it goes away from him and stays away from him for a while, will it pile on itself? Will he keep looking? Will he get desperate for answers? I'm thinking he might get desperate for answers. Now, does that mean he leaves Cameron McCormick? I don't think so. Or fires Mike Greller? Probably not. I mean, they've got so much history together. They work well together. But I think Spieth could go into a dark place for a little while, trying to figure out his game, trying to get it back. And he's going to be the kind of guy that when he has the right week, he's unstoppable. And when he doesn't, he's just going to be pretty solid. I mean, he's going to be well above average, but he's just going to be solid. Not going to be a guy that grinds out wins despite his not having his best stuff. That's not who he is. At least that's not who he is right now. He could become that again, but that's not who he is right now. And then I want to get into Phil. I'll come back to Tiger maybe at the end, but I want to get into Phil. There's been a lot of conversation about what he did on 13 on Saturday, hitting the ball while it was moving back toward the hole. So let's kind of take this into different parts. But first of all, I don't think the USGA applied the right ruling. Obviously, their choice was to apply what's known as Rule 14-5, which prohibits a golfer from playing a ball in motion, while in motion. The penalty for that is 2 strokes. That's what they said he did, because he didn't attempt to stop the ball or deflect it away from the hole. He played the ball with a stroke, is what the USGA said. So that means, in their view, Rule 1-2, which kind of is a more of a catch-all for doing stuff under the rules of golf that you shouldn't in terms of how you move the ball, that they said that doesn't apply. And in fairness, I believe it's note 1 on the rule, says that if there's another rule that more specifically covers the action in question, you refer to that rule. So the USGA said, well, 14-5 is more specific. It talks about hitting the ball while it's moving. This is where the penalty should be applied. 2-stroke penalty, keep on going. But covering the rules is Rule 33-7. That's the catch-all rule, basically, that the committee can decide to apply a penalty or not if they believe a serious breach of etiquette has occurred. I would consider this a serious breach of etiquette. He should be disqualified under that rule. He was not. So I think the USGA did a disservice to the players in the field, the people watching, and to Phil Mickelson by letting him play the final round on Sunday. That said, I understand why Phil did what he did. And it wasn't his explanation. It wasn't that he wanted to do this forever, so he just did it, and he tried to outsmart everybody and save a couple strokes or save a stroke or whatever by hitting it back and then trying to make the putt. I don't think Phil knew the rule he was breaking based on the conversation that he appeared to have with Andrew Johnston, who he played with that day, where he basically said to Beef, I don't know what my score is going to be. Whatever the penalty is they give me, they give me. So he probably didn't know he had incurred a 2-stroke penalty, or he couldn't add 8+2, which is unlikely. So he probably didn't know the rule, because if he knew the rule, he would have immediately declared that ball unplayable, and he would have returned back to the original spot and played that putt again with a 1-stroke penalty instead of incurring a 2-stroke penalty for hitting the ball back at the hole. I think that honestly would have been more controversial to basically just say, all right, and then he could have done it over and over again just to prove his point if he really wanted. But that was the proper play under the rules. Declare unplayable, replay the stroke with a 1-stroke penalty. Didn't do that. So I don't think he knew the rule in question. So I think that the only explanation here was he wanted to embarrass the USGA. Mission accomplished on a variety of levels. One, he drew all the attention away from the championship on Saturday afternoon when it should have been on Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, and the formative hours of the tournament determining who was going to be really in the hunt on Sunday. And we were all talking about, well, should Phil be disqualified or this or that, or what did he do? Is that wrong? And meanwhile, the USGA was in a no-win situation. If they disqualify him, they probably get a more intense reaction than they got. Imagine that. Because the people who like Phil and thought what he did really wasn't a problem would be in an uproar. Instead, people like me, who's a competitive golfer, and I'm sure you probably are too, who would never think of doing such a thing in a competitive round, is like, come on, you got to disqualify him for that. And that, so basically they chose to take the path of least resistance and let him continue playing. Okay, well then, if you're the USGA and you've set this precedent under the rules of golf, now there's decisions under the rules of golf, which is basically the addendum to all of the rules as written that tell you how to interpret those rules based on very specific situations. Now we have a precedent that says this is okay. Now, this is different because this situation at the U.S. Open, all his ball would have done was roll onto turf and keep rolling in turf. But what if it were to roll instead in a bunker or a water hazard? I mean, we've had experiences like that at the Masters in the last couple of years at 15 where someone hits a good shot and then from behind the green, and either it's a chip or a putt, and they've missed the mark and it rolls into the water. what if that person just ran after it now and decides, all right, I'm gonna take a fill and hit it back toward the hole and take the penalty, or declare it unplayable and then just take the one-stroke penalty and hit back from there. That's crazy talk. That's amazing that the USGA would allow that precedent to be set. And then Phil ultimately did this because he felt the USGA setup was making a mockery of him and the players, so he wanted to make a mockery of them. That is the only way you can interpret his action, that the purpose of it. You can interpret it as funny. I mean, it was funny. It's simultaneously, it was also embarrassing, and he should have been disqualified. It can be both those things. And I feel like the reaction to that only proves that most people don't understand nuance, that everything is black and white these days. I am a big fan of the gray area. There are a lot of things going on here. And you can be simultaneously entertained that something absolute batshit crazy happened, and also annoyed that he did it, and annoyed that he wasn't properly penalized for what he did. Both those things can be true. And that's how I feel about Phil. He's had a history of doing things like this in championships, not just the U.S. Open. He's done stuff like this in other major championships, in regular PGA Tour events, to incur the wrath of fans and the media with a point. There's always a point. There's a reason why Phil wore a dress shirt in a practice round with Tiger at the Masters, because a lot of people were going to be paying attention, and he had a deal with Mizzen and Main in hand. And I tweeted about it that day, like, just wait and see, here it comes. And there it was at the Players. Oh, he's got a deal on an equity stake. Who could have guessed? That's basically insider trading without the trading part. He knew. He knew what was going to happen. Phil's not an idiot. He knew. He knows what the reaction is going to be. Now, he may try to give you a half-assed explanation of why just to make you feel better about it. But that's why he does stuff. He does it with a purpose to send a message or sell something. And if you're okay with that, then you love Phil. If you're not okay with that, you probably don't love him. And me, I find myself increasingly in the middle. When I was 13, 14, 15, I loved Phil Mickelson more than Tiger Woods, because I love the guy who's struggling to get to the top. And frankly, I should still love that story 20 years later, because that's where I am in life. But I find myself thinking more and more, if you just said what your piece was and didn't make a lavish point about it, you would still be as effective. It's kind of how I run GNN. And so I find myself increasingly at odds with how Phil Mickelson conducts himself. And this is one of those instances where, like, yeah, I know you've done this before, but now I see it through a different prism, and I don't think this was right. And then the USGA, what are they supposed to do? Just take it? DQ them? Again, no win situation on a day where they already knew the golf course was getting away from them. They knew that. And I think that David Duval made an extremely good point after Saturday play on Golf Channel and said, if you set up the golf course for 8 a.m. on Saturday feeling pretty good about it, but knowing it was going to go to the edge near then how can you feel like you didn't think the golf course was going to get away from you less than 12 hours later? Because it did. And I don't really put a whole lot of stock in what Zach Johnson had to say about the golf course. Oh, they lost it. Zach Johnson whines a lot. I wasn't buying into that sentiment. But what started to make me think was Scott Piercy's putt on 15. I thought the pin there was not right. And I was okay, really, with the pin on 18 because some guys were, you were able to hold the green. I mean, Charlie Hoffman had a fantastic shot in there and held the green. Just had to hit it short and run it up. Or you had to hit it basically 20 feet short of the pin high, you know, and let it bounce. That worked. That's okay. And then for the USGA to come out and kind of tiptoe around an apology they didn't need to make, to be truthful. Everyone suffered. The only crazy thing about it all was that someone playing basically out the first five groups, two of them got into the final group because the golf course got extremely difficult. Well, that was the point. The Saturday of the U.S. Open is supposed to be extremely difficult. That's the point. Thursday and Friday, you kind of have to even it out a little bit because the weather and the draw, especially on a windswept course like Shinnecock, they knew the forecast. They had to try to do their best. They took the throttle off on Thursday. On Friday, they got exposed when the wind died down on Friday afternoon, made the difference more clear between early, late, and late early. And on Saturday, they do what they always do. We want to make this golf course as most difficult as we can, and we want to see who sorts it out. And that all would have worked just fine had there not been a Tony Finau, Daniel Berger final group from 11 shots back. Just how it would have been fine. The guys would have bitched, because that's what they do, but the setup was fine. Aside from 15 pin. Everything else was okay. Paul Anuwa gets bumpy. That's in the greens. There's nothing you can do about it. The rough was very penal. Well, it's been that way the whole time. The wind picked up a little bit in the afternoon, but not that much more. Just the golf course got firmer and faster, and these guys didn't cope very well with it. But they're not supposed to be able to cope well with it. That's the point of the U.S. Open. The point of this is to increase the level of difficulty to the point that you weed everybody out on Saturday, then you pull the throttle back a little bit, just a little bit, on Sunday, to let guys move around on their own accord instead of who suffers the least, it's who thrives the best. And I think that they accomplished that with this championship. I really do. I mean, look at the board. Look who was there. Basically, everyone you thought was going to be there, given their current form and how they handled the U.S. Open test. And everybody who's not been playing that great was exposed. Either they barely made the cut, or they were exposed in the third round, or they didn't make the cut at all. That's what we got. We got the best golfers right now at the top of that board. We had Dustin Johnson. We had Brooks Koepka. We had Justin Rose. Henrik Stenson had a very good year. Wouldn't put him in the top three, but okay, he was there too. That's a good board. Sue me. I think USGA did fine. Could they have been a little bit better on Saturday? Yeah, they could have. And could they have made it a little bit more difficult on Sunday instead of pulling the string way too far back to have so many pins in reasonably accessible locations, almost to the point that it was not easy, but easier, way easier than Saturday? Yeah, could have done that. Could have leveled the Saturday-Sunday round difference out a little bit. But other than that, I thought it was okay. And the problem is PGA Tour players who go about their game week to week are tested on a very different set of questions than they get at the U.S. Open. And they're dealing with folks at the PGA Tour who do setups every week designed to entertain with birdies and eagles and to really not put the players under a ton of stress. You know what you're going to get in a PGA Tour setup every week. You don't know what the USGA is going to do every year. It's a mystery. Every year it's a mystery. And I think that jars a lot of players. And I think it's become increasingly jarring as the money has gone up, as the attention these guys get changes. And not that there's a sense of entitlement, but there's a sense of expectation of how a golf course is meant to be set up. Shinnecock could have produced a great winner without all the stuff the USGA did to it. It probably would have. It's that great of a golf course. But the USGA feels that taking it to the absolute limit is their best way to identify a champion, and it is the character of their championship. It's 1 week a year. We do this with Phoenix every year. We're like, well, for 1 week of the year, that kind of thing is pretty good. Well, for 1 week a year, the U.S. Open is also really good. And they're about to go into a stretch of incredible venues. We're going to get Pebble next year, Wingfoot after that, Torrey, Country Club at Brookline, which we haven't seen in, what, 30 years? 29 years or 28 years? No, it was 30 years. You got L.A., Country Club North, which was riveting as a Walker Cup venue. And we head back to Pinehurst number 2, and then we've got Oakmont in there, and we've got Shinnecock in there again. I mean, it's going to be an incredible run for the U.S. Open of classic venues. This is what's going to happen. They're going to take every one of these courses to the limit. They're not going to, that's not the era of trying to accommodate players at 6-7 under par. Mm-mm. It's not happening for a while. Not so long as Mike Davis is doing the setup. Now, should Mike Davis do the setup and be the head of the organization? That's an iffy question. But I feel like this was okay. Other than 2 hours where everyone kind of got caught in an uproar, in part because Zach Johnson decided to speak, I thought it was okay. And this is what this championship should be. Needs character. Because otherwise, if they just let it play, that's what the PGA Championship is. The British Open, the Open, whatever, has its own identity. So does the Masters. So what is the identity of the U.S. Open to be without making it as difficult as humanly possible? It's just another PGA Championship. Just another PGA Tour event. What differentiated that from the Players or from Memorial or any number of good golf tournaments the PGA Tour runs? That's it. So I think that they could have done better a little bit on Saturday afternoon. Yep, could have done a little bit better on Sunday. But overall speaking, passing grade at least, to give them a B. Wasn't an A. No, you can't do that. But I'd say a B. And if the Players graded it worse, then the USGA won. And that's the point. That's what the USGA wants to do. They want to get in your head, and they want to make you think and doubt and wonder. And if they've got you before you step foot on the golf course, like they did Rory, like they did Phil, like they did other players, then the tournament is over for you before you even play. It's over. Brooks Koepka didn't complain when he was given the opportunity to. He abstained. Dustin Johnson, same way. Abstained. Justin Rose admitted to it a little bit, but mostly abstained. Henrik Stenson made wisecracks about it, and he said the F-bomb a lot on Sky Sports, but more or less abstained. It's a matter of a mental test as much as it is a test of skill. And if you can't understand that, and you just start whining nonstop, then you've lost. You won't win, and the USGA has beaten you again. So for players who, like Rory, who have basically zonked out on the US Open, they're just going through the motions, that's going to be the rest of the way for their career. Because you have to reframe your thinking to be successful in the US Open. And if you don't, then there are only going to be a certain number of players who win every year. And you might as well start alternating trophies between the three or four guys who are really in it at the end. Because they're the ones who seem to be willing to handle this. Brooks Koepka could win four US Opens. If this is the way this generation handles this championship, he could win four or five. Not easily, but I could see him doing it. Couldn't you? All right, that's going to do it for us on this week's show. Appreciate you tuning in with us. Please give us a five-star review if you have a chance. Listen to us on iTunes. Helps us reach more people. Just go to our show on the podcast app, type in the 19th Hole Golf Show, and give us five stars. You can comment. Don't. If you read a comment or make a comment, we'll read it on the air if you got a question. We really appreciate it. And you can get a hold of me via email, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, if you feel so inclined. Next week on the show, we may have a surprise interview for you, a really big one. We're going to see if that works out or not. But if it does, you're going to love it. And it's going to be history-making for this show. We'll talk about that then, hopefully. But if not, we'll still do something cool talking about, obviously, the Travelers Championship, which has a great feel. But the final version of the National here in the D.C. area will be next week. So we'll talk about that as well, as it's our hometown tournament, at least for one more time. All right, I'm Ryan Balanchine saying thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week on the 19th Hole Golf Show.